Today, Australia in the eye of the storm and heading over the cliff. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering funds and proper news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined by Tarek Brooker, journalist. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. Hanging in there yourself?
Yeah, mate. Same here. It's all you can do in this world.
Every time we talk, there's more to talk about because things are just moving so fast. But we are, I think, at a very interesting inflection point because Phil Lowe, yesterday, when he was giving evidence, basically said, look, you can't just turn off all the support stimulus in September or we're going to create a cliff. And that perhaps is a little bit at odds with what the government was saying a little while ago, although they're going to be quiet about what they're going to do.
They have. I think that they're just really just trying to just wait and see what happens. And I think a little bit of the problem at the moment is you're seeing very, very different signals from the data. Like in terms of like consumer spending, it's bounced back quite well. You're seeing, you know, an increase in consumer confidence, at least for people's own personal circumstances. But by the same token, unemployment is still likely rising, you know, slowly but surely. And I mean, we haven't really seen it much improvement in the labor market, according to the latest ABS data they released today, despite the fact that we're seeing, shops reopening and the economy reopening.
Yes, I mean, it is puzzling in a way to try and work out what's going on. What we do know, we know a few things. We know that there are some households who are now receiving more income than they did previously because when they're on JobSeeker, there's a minimum and many people were actually earning below that minimum. So they're doing quite well. We also know that about half the households who got the interest and capital repayment holiday from the bank, from their mortgage, had no change in their income. So some of them are also making hay as well, right? So I think that's part of what's going on. But we also know that there are a lot of small businesses that are really being crushed. And we also know that there are about 3 million households who might have expected to be on JobKeeper but aren't on JobKeeper. And I don't think that's good news. I don't think that means that they are magically insulated from what's going on. More likely, those businesses that employed them weren't able or willing to engage around JobKeeper, partly because of the cash flow issues and partly because they hadn't necessarily dropped their turnover to trigger it. So you put all that together, and it is a very confusing picture, but I think the labour data is unfortunately pointing for more bad news for quite some time. And the RBA is still saying, unemployment's going to be higher next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a quite a sort of confusing time because, interestingly enough, like I was going through the data in terms of the super withdrawals, and in the last 30 days, we've seen $10.6 billion withdrawn from super accounts. Now, to put that into perspective, Rudd's $950 cash handouts totaled a cost to the government of about $12.7 million. So here we have something that's, 80% already of Rudd's stimulus solely from people withdrawing their super. So, and this is only anecdotal, I can't say with any great, sort of definitiveness, but I'm hearing of people, using that money to put a deposit on a house. I'm hearing of people using that to fund consumption, to, buy cars or to do all sorts of things. And I think that's creating this really interesting distortion. I wrote an article about it a few days ago, and we're looking at something at the moment where one in every $8 in GDP for the last month came from either government stimulus or from people withdrawing their super. And that's a huge amount of money to be washing through the system, particularly at a time when In some ways, things aren't as bad as we would have thought they may have been at this point.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because, I survey my households and one of the questions we've started asking is super withdrawals and why. And about half of the super withdrawals in our surveys are actually putting it towards a deposit for a house. I was surprised by that. I mean, I expected it was more about sort of just, running costs. But no. This is a deliberate strategy. They're saying it's better to take that money out, okay, and I'll do the same after the end of this financial year when I can get the second tranche. And that gives me then a bit of a sort of a pool of money to buy a house, and then I'll wait for the government to come in with the next 95% scheme, and then I'm going to buy a house.
It's the Australian way, mate. I was just looking at the RBA aggregate credit data this morning, and it was just like you know, owner occupiers still going out there, still getting mortgages. And, you know, it's housing, it's the unstoppable of Australia. No pandemic, no mass unemployment will ever stop it, apparently.
Well, of course, the credit numbers will rise, right? Because essentially a few things are happening. Firstly, people are not making any repayments, so there's a natural slight growth in credit balances. We also know that a number of people are refinancing, and in the process of refinancing, sometimes grabbing a bit more equity and using that. So that's another lever. And we still know there are some first-time buyers that are still in there. So yeah, it is an amazing story. And, you know, as I've often said, there is a strong association between the momentum in credit growth, the change in credit growth particularly, and home prices. And in fact, if credit growth stays or improves from where it is now, then you'd have to say, well, maybe prices aren't going to drop as much as people, including myself, were thinking. I mean, I was basically of the view that because of the high unemployment and the underemployment, household incomes would be crushed, and that would put more people over the edge, and banks would tighten up, and that would drive it down. But if in fact the credit is actually going to be a little stronger, and if in fact households are still going to spend, and if in fact the impact on the broader economy is less severe, then maybe we're going to get away with it.
I think that in a lot of ways we've managed to postpone it. Now we've kicked the can down the road till sort of, you know, end of September, start of October, when things will start to get a real picture of what's actually going on. Because at the moment, you know, you look at all these various different metrics, and, you know, people think that yes, the next few months may be a little bit challenging, but when you go beyond that time horizon, I think Melbourne University had a study out, I think it was yesterday, and they were saying that basically very few people, I think only about 20% of people, believe that this is going to affect them for longer than the next 12 months, despite the fact that they believe that it's going to affect the economy for far longer than that. So there's this interesting sort of divergence between how people perceive themselves and their position in all of this, in this crisis, and how they perceive the economy, which is much, much poorer. And I think this could lead to a really, really interesting situation when the time does come to end JobKeeper in September. Because I have a theory that when that day comes, the government's going to be looking at the July retail sales report, which I think may be actually quite good, relatively speaking, because of the super withdrawals, the second round of super withdrawals are going to become available. And, you know, people may even get some early tax returns and all that sort of thing. And I think we may see a situation where, on paper, consumer confidence has bounced back, and retail sales have bounced back, and then perhaps even rising to a decent degree, and everything looks quite rosy. But when you put it all together, and you realise how much money is being sent into the economy, injected into the economy by the government, and by all these various schemes like the super withdrawals, you realize that it's quite weak, but it may create a picture that gives a false sense of confidence. And that's what makes me think that perhaps the government will send it off the cliff, because they'll think, oh, it's okay. Look at all these other metrics. Unemployment's a lagging indicator, but these things, all these other things say everything's fine and we should be fine. And then, you know, you come off the cliff and you're just running there in the air, hoping that everything's going to be fine, and it's not.
Yeah, that wonderful cartoon picture, which I think sums up so well many proportions of the economy. But, you know, you're right about longevity and the need to think longer term here, right? I was reading the other day, the Federal Reserve, one of the vice feds, gave evidence to a particular committee. And one of the questions that they asked that individual was, for how long will the Federal Reserve do bond buying? And will they hold their five-year bonds to duration, or will they sell them back, right? And the Fed said, we will continue our bond buying process, and we will continue to hold the bonds that we actually buy. So that tells you that they're thinking that they're going to need to intervene in the market for at least 5 years. And because they actually get interest on those bonds, they will actually reinvest those bonds too. So they're going to continue to do this for quite a long period of time. Now, that probably gives us a clue to how much support the financial system will need post the current crisis. Remember, they were doing some of this even before we had COVID, right? So, you know, they started putting liquidity in the market in September when we had this this repo crisis. So I think we've got to come back and understand that this is not just a conversation about the virus and its immediate impact, but it's actually the bigger conversation about what the health of the overall economy was and is and will be. And I have a view, like you, that we have to think longer term. Remember that underemployment will probably still be extremely in the wrong place. Unemployment will be still very high to the end of next year. And all of those stimuluses, be it JobKeeper, be it the repayment holidays on mortgages, be it repayment holidays on credit cards, and I'm not even sure whether the free childcare is going to continue into the future, right? I mean, there are so many elements that at some point the government is either going to say, we're going to turn it off and try and get the budget back into some sort of, you know, semblance of shape, or we'll have to let it run. And if you let it run, that's a bit anti-dogma of the current party, isn't it?
I mean, we had a conversation, I think it was a few months ago now, and at the time I said that ScoMo was going to look to return to his ideological agenda as soon as possible. And a lot of people at the time were saying, no, that can't happen. You know, we've got this enormous crisis. There's no way they're going to end JobKeeper. And then, you know, later you've got Barnaby Joyce and all these other various coalition MPs saying, we need to end it. And I mean, you know, some of them are even talking about using it to leverage the states to reopen so they can get the economy going by getting rid of it. And I can't see Scott Morrison continuing to hand out billions upon billions upon billions. And I think we're already seeing that with the leftover money from JobKeeper that they thought they were going to spend, but Treasury got it wrong. And you're not seeing any commitment from the Morrison government that money is going to be put towards propping up the economy to any significant degree. And on the sort of the point of the Fed in America, I think we're going to get some very interesting signals and some very interesting data from the US in the next few months that's going to really guide how the Morrison government approaches this potentially, if they're smart. Because at the end of July, the $600 a week bonus unemployment benefits end in the US. Right now, Minneapolis is on fire because of the killing of a black man by a police officer. And if you put all the various problems that America has, and then you take away, you know, in some cases, we'll call it almost 2/3 of people's unemployment benefits overnight, you're going to get a real signal of how the economy is going to perform in reality without that stimulus. And I think it could paint a quite a concerning picture for the government, although there's always it doesn't matter. We're the lucky country. Australia's different.
I've heard that a few times. You know, we are unique. Our property market is unique. Our economy is unique, etc., etc. I'm not totally sure that's true. But it's also just worth reflecting. Generally, if you look at our overall GDP, more comes from our overseas trade than the local, right? I mean, you know, half of the overall activity is to do with consumer, but a lot of it is overseas. Now, if the overseas markets and overseas countries continue to struggle with COVID longer than we do, and if the international borders remain shut so that we don't get the education and the tourist dollar coming in, those factors will no doubt have a negative impact on what's happening here. But I think you're dead right. The US is the one to watch, because there are so many factors there in play at the moment. We've got the election, of course, later on in the year. We've got very high unemployment at the moment, and we've got the Fed essentially throwing liquidity into the financial system and to support the US financial system and beyond. Also worth noting, though, of course, that the Eurozone has now said that they're going to put a big package together and they're going to give grants to some of their struggling countries, despite the fact that some of the richer countries in Europe don't want to do that, like Denmark, for example. So there's whole loads of things in play. But the final point to make is China seems to be slowing, not accelerating at the moment, if you look at their performance. And they're not actually putting a stake in the ground as to what they think the growth is going to be next year, which suggests to me that they're not sure exactly which way it's going to go there. And then if you put all that together and say, and then we've got the Hong Kong factor and the fact that you know, the US and some other Western countries have all started throwing rocks at China about that. It's going to get tricky.
Tricky. I think that will be an understatement when we look on this video in hindsight. No, I mean, you look at all the various different factors, and it's very much the sort of the death of this current version of globalization. It's not the death of globalization as a whole. You know, globalization has died multiple times over the last couple of hundred years, and every time it's come back in a new changed form. But, you know, if you look at some of the more, you know, shall we say, reliable data coming out of China that isn't pumped out by Beijing, it's not really all that rosy. You know, they say, oh, but cars are back on the road. And it's like, well, that's because people don't want to ride public transport, which is, you know, a pretty sort of fair way of looking at things. And I can't help but think about 1928 as you know, like people think of the depression that it began on the day that the US stock market crashed, but it didn't. You know, there was already problems in places like Japan and other places around the world long before that happened. There was issues with too much debt, with too much leverage, you know. And I'm quite concerned that we're going to start seeing something similar again, because at the moment, people aren't really, and people and the market aren't pricing that negative feedback loop that you see in this type of environment. And, you know, to use an overused word, you know, this is unprecedented. You know, we risk this negative feedback loop going around the world and around the world. And I think you're right that China is going to be a key bellwether of that. Because if their factories don't get back to work and they don't get the sales they need, you know, you're going to see a second round of layoffs. Some say we're already seeing this. You know, you're going to see them not consuming as many bulk commodities. You're going to see them exporting deflation, and all this stuff has a you know, the feedback loop effect that will eventually flow around the world. And as for Australia, there was an interesting chart by Robert Rennie from Westpac yesterday showing that coal export volumes had started dropping for thermal coal going out of Newcastle and all sorts of other ports in Australia. And if that happens, you know, if we start to see a drop off in bulk commodities, whether it's coal or iron ore, but if you see a significant drop off, it's going to really hit GDP and it's really going to hit the budget. Because I mean, other than the sort of major resource producing nations like, you know, the Saudis and all that sort of stuff, we are one of the most resource reliant countries on the face of the earth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, if you look at one of there's a chart, and I can't remember where it's come from, but it shows the relative complexity of different economies around the world, right? And Australia is quite close to the bottom, you know, like some African countries. You know, the complexity of our economy is very, very small relative to many others. And that means you're way more exposed if these things change. And also, you know, because we haven't really invested in, you know, creating momentum locally through manufacturing and those things, we are very reliant on those international trade arrangements and on the international flows of money in and out. And if you're right, and I think you probably are, that the international order is morphing into something quite different, and the international view of, you know, globalism is perhaps now fracturing, as it does seem to be, it means, I think, that we're going to have a completely different perspective on our role globally, and that actually then comes back to how our economy is going to be actually crafted for the future. And my own view would be we need to focus more on doing things locally and actually reinvesting in things like real infrastructure that can create value for the future and real businesses that can create value for the future, and maybe less on just pumping up the housing sector again, and a little less on just trying to flog more of the resources overseas at no added value. I mean, those are big policy questions. And the question I suppose I've got is the current government up for it, or are they just going to play the old cards again?
No, they're not up for it. I think I can say that pretty unequivocally, to be honest. I mean, this is arguably the biggest crisis that any government in Australian history will ever face in terms of its direct short-term economic impact. You know, even the depression was spaced out over, the pain was spaced out over a period of years. And, you know, this, you know, the bulk of this crisis is going to be experienced between now and the end of the year, with obviously some significant tail effects. But I look at the plans they're coming out with, and what is Morrison calling it? Jobmaker? What a load of crap. I'm sorry, but you look at the thing, and, you know, all look at the plan, and you see like all these other nations are talking about let's reindustrialize, let's build pharmaceutical factories, let's build car factories, let's build up our tech sector. Here in Australia, it's let's subsidize gas, let's redo Work Choices 2.0 and gut the industrial relations system. They say they're going to want to work with the unions, but I have a feeling that's window dressing, you know. And you look at all these various plans they're putting forward, and you know, I mean, they're talking about cutting corporate taxes. We already did that. It didn't work. But we're going to do it again because that's what the government's ideological priorities are. And what we need is like what we've previously discussed, what you've discussed with Robbie Barwick about, you know, a national, you know, investment bank to invest in our future. You know, we need to be looking at things like drought-proofing Australia, making ourselves, you know, more self-sufficient, you know, bringing things like pharmaceuticals and technology and innovative industries to our shores, you know, and not only that, but encouraging the people who are here to get into those industries rather than just go, off, I'll bugger it. I'm going to go buy a house or buy a couple of houses and live off that and be the next Nathan Birch.
Yeah, Nathan's getting a bit of a tough time at the moment. What I find is really interesting, of course, is that if the government is thinking election cycle rather than economic cycle, then their major task is to try and not let things deteriorate too significantly up to the next election, right? So they want to try and keep house prices up as high as they can. They want to try and tackle as far as they can some of these short-term issues to be able to get to that next election, right? I actually think that the election cycle is actually a real distraction from the longer-term strategic thinking that we should be doing as a nation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it may sound a little bit, you know, Bolshevik, but we need a 5-year plan. We need a 10-year plan. You know, like, I mean, it's not like bipartisanship in Australia is impossible. It's not. When it comes to all these security legislation, when it comes to foreign relations, Labor and the Liberals are in lockstep. They may get out of step a little bit now and then, but realistically, we all know that eventually they're gonna agree and they're gonna press on the same course. Mm. And I think that it shows that we can do it. I mean, you look at, you know, Joel Fitzgibbon and Matt Canavan sitting down. They can sit down and they can agree on coal. Why can't we all sit down and agree on something that we can put together a plan for the future of our country? Mm. And I think that we really need to look at things because, to be completely frank with you, I don't think as a nation we do enough to justify the wages that we get relative to the rest of the world. We are one of the most well-paid nations in the world. You know, I mean, if you work at a checkout at Woolworths, you earn more money than some people do doing, you know, sort of professional high-level jobs in parts of Europe. Mm. And we need to justify our wages and our living standards. And we're not doing that. We can't just keep digging stuff out the ground, sending it to China, and then, you know, selling houses to each other. I mean, I know that that's not what a lot of people want to hear, but that's what needs to happen because, you know, there have been other countries like us. If you look at Argentina going back to the turn of the 20th century, they were up there. They were one of the highest countries in the world. I think they may have even been number one country in the world for per capita GDP. And then they had 100 years of absolute garbage, and now they're where they are. And that could be us if we're not careful. I mean, like you say, we're as economically complex as Uganda, and we really need to do something to change that, to be able to give, you know, our children and future generations the kind of living standards that we've come to enjoy.
Mm. Well, I think you're right. And look, you know, going back to the title of this show, we are, I think, in the eye of the storm at the moment, insofar that it's relatively calm and, you know, there's a little bit of wriggle room there. But shortly, we are actually going to be confronting the next part of the storm. And if we're not very careful, that cliff is going to be very close. And, you know, the decisions that we take over the next 3 to 6 to 12 months are going to determine the future for the next 20, 30 years, probably. So it's important to get them right.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think one of the key things is that the government and the media is looking at all these easily accessible indicators, things like, you know, consumer confidence, things like consumer spending. Mm. You know, we're going to probably look at retail sales. And I have a feeling that the May ones are going to be quite rosy and they're all going to get very, very excited about it. But But at the end of the day, if you go out there and you talk to business owners, you talk to executives who are the ones making these decisions for these medium and large companies, and I've heard them all say very similar things. They say to you, we're not sure how this is going to play out. We're not sure about the government's plan. It's nothing's concrete. Nothing's really all that supportive, you know, beyond, you know, the September, you know, sort of window. And until we start providing some certainty and a plan for the future that people have faith in, all we're doing is kicking the can down the road. You know, a lot of these companies are waiting to see what happens before they pull the trigger on firing people, because you don't want to, you know, this isn't like, you know, firing a casual who you can just, you know, easily rehire and find someone else to pack a box. You know, this is people in professional roles or people who are, you know, very qualified, lots of experience. They're not going to fire these people overnight. But unless we can give these companies a reason to believe in the future, they will get some of these people will get sacked down the road. And it's going to be a lot harder to get those jobs back than it is to get, you know, someone who works at Woolworths. You know, it's a much, much longer process. It's all well and good, like in the US, it's all well and good for Trump to say, oh, we made X number of jobs since the financial crisis. But when you look into the actual demographics, they're not the jobs that you really, really want to be creating.
Yeah, well, that's always it. I mean, you know, even here in Australia, there's been we've created lots and lots of jobs, but if you look at them, a lot of them are actually in very important roles in the healthcare sector and those sorts of things. But a lot of that is essentially just kicking the same dollar around the system, right? And it's just effectively services that provides services to other parts of the economy, but it doesn't actually grow the economy, right? Neither, by the way, does inflating house prices and lifting mortgages grow the economy, right? It just makes the numbers bigger, but it actually doesn't really serve any productive purpose. So we have to find a productive route from this point, but that, I think, as you're touching on, requires us to measure some things differently. You know, maybe even GDP is not a very good measure of anything useful, by the way. You know, maybe there are other metrics that we need to think about. And I just worry that the current government are really locked into yesterday's thinking with yesterday's ideas, and they'll just throw those at it again and have another go. Get through the next election, and then basically the electorate will say, well, they got us through that crisis, so we'll bring them back for another gig, you know. And it's like, this could go on, but unfortunately we'll have missed the opportunity to lay the foundations that I think need to be laid for, you know, the future prosperity of Australians and Australia.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think we're in an interesting position compared with the rest of the world, because we do have relatively low government debt. We're in this position where we could kick the can down the road. The government could throw, you know, 100, 200, 300 billion at the economy every year. We could probably even save their property market if we really wanted to spend enough.
Yeah.
But should we? That's the key question, I think. We could, but should we? And I just don't really see that there's the appetite to do that kind of can kicking, unless it's very, very targeted at the property market. But by the same token, I also think the government wants to get the budget, you know, back into balance. I don't think that, I mean, even the so-called moderate Liberal MPs, I've heard from some, you know, you hear from some of them in the media, and they're saying JobKeeper needs to end. We need to balance the budget. We need to do all these different things. And if that's what the moderate Liberal MPs are saying, and that's what, you know, is coming out of the party room, what are the ones in the middle of the party or the right wing of the party saying about ending JobKeeper, about removing all of these stimulus measures and, you know, returning to what they like to call it, a free market economy? I mean, yeah, we can have a free market economy, go for it. If you want to crash housing prices and drive us into a depression, yeah, go for it. Mm. But I mean, I understand that it's an incredibly difficult time to govern. You know, you need to get, as you say, this is what the decisions they make now are going to echo through the next couple of decades for us. But I'm concerned that they don't have the required vision and the required ideological flexibility to be able to change tack the way they need to. And to be completely honest, they need to do it soon. You know, they've got 4 months. A little over 4 months until JobKeeper ends. And when it does end, they're going to need to have another plan. Because if it ends and there is no other plan and it's just, oh, we'll kick the can down the road, we'll keep JobKeeper on for tourism or whatever, that's not enough. We need a better plan that is going to be a job maker. to quote Scott Morrison, that is going to get people back into work, that is going to, you know, reignite some confidence. And we've spoken about this before, but I think we really just need a sort of Churchillian leader, you know, someone who's going to get out there and say, yes, things are going to be hard. Yes, things are going to be difficult and sacrifices are going to have to be made. All us politicians are going to take pay cuts. You know, we're going to cut, you know, the some of these public servants' wages who are earning $600,000 a year. And we're going to be down in the trenches with you, rebuilding this economy and rebuilding this country in a better way than it was before, rather than what we have from Scott Morrison, which is get stuffed, I'm keeping my pay rise. And our plan is that we're going to press our ideological agenda and that's it. And that really isn't enough. And that's why you're seeing all these businesses being so concerned about the future, because they know in their heart of hearts, despite the fact that some of them may even donate to the Liberal Party, that what the government is doing is not in their best interests.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think you're putting your finger on some very important issues there. I spoke to Senator Gerard Rennick the other day. In fact, I'll put a link to the show, because he's actually in the Liberal Party in Queensland. But he's basically saying somewhat similar things, that we have to find a different path from where we are if we're to be successful. And I have to say that somebody in politics, you know, in essentially Canberra, saying that and being prepared to come on the record and actually express it, I thought was pretty impressive. And actually, it's worth listening to his show, because he actually made some, I think, some really important points, because we are at a critical decision point. And the worry is, if we don't actually make the right decisions now, after job keeper, job seeker and job maker, we could equally have job killer. And my worry is that isn't one that people don't necessarily want to talk about. But if we make the wrong decisions, job killer will be there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, these next, you know, 6, 9, 12 months are going to be instrumental. And the problem is that if you don't get it right now, you risk that horrible feedback loop.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's part of the problem as well. And we've talked about it before, that when you've got, you know, the sort of money flowing through the services economy, when you start yanking these links out of the economy while it's basically sedated, it's going to wake up and think, oh my God. And then everything needs to heal. Everything needs to get put back together, and the economy needs to rebalance. But I think what's happening with JobKeeper is that's not happening. We're not seeing, you know, people looking for other jobs. They're hoping that their job's going to come back. We have no idea how many zombie jobs there are. We can only estimate. And eventually, you know, when JobKeeper does end, unless we see a material, in, you know, bounce back in business confidence, these people are going to lose their jobs. And that's going to have the effect of ripping all that consumer spending out of the economy, at the same time as they're ripping all the stimulus out of the economy. And then you just risk this horrible negative feedback loop of just, oh, well, I can't afford to pay my personal trainer, who can't afford to go out and get a coffee, who can't afford to go to their accountant. And it just creates this horrible negative feedback loop. And that's the really, really big concern here. Because if we do that rosy scenario that we previously discussed of, you know, rising consumer confidence and consumer spending, and the government does yank it all, thinking that it's the right decision, you know, I don't want to think about how bad that could get for the economy and for the people who are going to have to endure those job losses.
Mm. Yeah, well, as you say, big decisions ahead. We hope that those in power are thinking about it the right way, and maybe they should watch this show to get some ideas about what they should be doing.
Yeah, share with your local MP.
Exactly. Well, not so serious, you know, maybe that's a bit more serious than you might think. I do think we have to try and raise the level of conversation and raise the level of debate and move the conversation on from, frankly, what, you know, even the mainstream media are doing, because they're not doing anybody a service by not actually highlighting these big strategic questions that should be being thought about now.
Well, I think we're in a little bit of an interesting position here, because if they did start highlighting these issues more closely, you know, if, I mean, like I wrote a few days ago that, you know, one in every $4.50 in GDP in the last 30 days has been driven by government, by welfare spending or stimulus,
yeah,
stimulus measures. I mean, if people, you know, sort of read that, they'd be going, oh my God, you know, we're basically, you know, sort of heading for the Soviet Union in terms of the amount of government, you know, government intervention in the economy. And, you know, it's a tough one to sell to the public. I know that from experience.
Well, I'll tell you something else before we close. Think about the moral hazard that was being created, right? If enough people complain enough about the fact that they can't get a job and they need job seeker and job keeper to continue, right? You could actually be in the situation where effectively the government is almost forced to continue to make these payments into the future, right? And you know, so there's a moral hazard there. There's a second moral hazard insofar that, of course, the banks are getting royal treatment from the Reserve Bank in terms of access to cheap funds. And of course, the banks will turn around and say, we need more of that, more of that. So there are moral hazards here as well. I mean, it's just, you know, wherever you look.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that we've found ourselves in a position now where we've walked into the middle of the minefield blindfolded. And we've been lucky so far, but now we've got to get out. And that's the hard part. You know, people saying, oh, you know, I won't name names, but some people are saying, oh, you know, we've already passed the worst of it. It's like, well, no, we've got the economy into the hospital. We've got it on life support. You know, we've got all hooked up, and now we've got to, you know, take all these things off, you know, take off the ventilator, you know, take off all these different things. And we have to see what happens when we do that. And yeah. I'm not sure how they're going to go about that. It's like you say, it's a very tough one.
Yeah, and you know, going back to the analogy of the eye in the storm, we're in the eye. It's a little bit calm at the moment, but we know that the next phase of the storm is coming, and we need to be prepared. Tarek, I appreciate your time today. Very fascinating conversation as always, and we'll keep in touch as these things develop further.
Yeah, definitely, mate. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks very much. Take care.
You too, mate. Bye. We'll